Kathy Bush has one of the coolest jobs I've ever heard of. She is the playwright in residence at the State Theater of Virginia, the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia. And today she's going to tell us all about writing a musical play. Now, why would we be talking to a playwright? Why are we talking about a musical play and the creative process? Well, it turns out that her subject is very constitutional. Her play is called Winter Wheat, and it's about the feminist movement. It is about specifically the movement for women's suffrage and how it climaxed in the great state of Tennessee. To Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about winter wheat.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
The 19th Amendment and the right of women to vote is one of the pivotal moments in American constitutional history, and we've paid a lot of attention to it on this particular show. Indeed, if you want to Google us, your Weekly Constitutional, go to our podcast site. You can find several episodes devoted to the subject of women's suffrage. But it's such a great story that it really needs to be told a number of different times and in different ways. And that's the key to today's episode, because today we're going to talk about a play, a musical play called Winter Wheat, that was written by a woman named Kathy Bush.
My name is Kathy Bush, and I am the playwright in residence at Barter Theater. So what that means is I sit in my kitchen a lot and write plays. Jealous?
I'm extremely jealous, but that has to be one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of someone's vocation. So you're the playwright in residence at Barter Theater. What does that mean?
Basically, what it means is that Rick Rose, who's the producing artistic director, will, if he has an idea for a play or a subject matter he thinks we need to touch on, he will commission me. I'll get an email. I'll see him at an opening of a show, and he'll say, hey, I need you to write... think about a play on this topic. And so...
So that he commissions particular plays.
Yes, he does. Commission from me, which is so wonderful. And I'm probably the luckiest playwright in America, because I am one of the few I know who make enough. You know, it's not a fortune, but I live in Abingdon. I don't live in New York. I did for 14 years, so I know of what I speak. Mm-hmm. And I live in a place where I can afford to live and do that and not have to have the day job of teaching or some other ways of supporting my habit, of my playwriting habit.
Supporting, you speak is almost as if it's a drug.
It is. There's much easier ways to make a living.
People are probably curious why we have a playwright on here, and we'll come back to talking about the artistic process and being a playwright and all that in just a minute. But the particular reason that we have you on our show, which is about the Constitution broadly defined, is because you've recently written a play about the Constitution, right?
Yes, it's called Winter Wheat, and it's a musical about the ratification of the 19th Amendment or woman suffrage.
A musical?
A musical.
About the ratification. You know what immediately comes to mind are those scenes in the old Mary Poppins movie.
Sister Suffragette. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've seen that, right?
Oh, I can quote it. I know the whole song. And I will spare you me singing it.
Oh, I didn't know. That was going to be my next question.
No,
you're not going to sing it for it? Oh, okay. So you're not a singer yourself?
No. I tried to be an actor once, and I was so bad at it, I became a playwright instead. That was kind of my, and in a nutshell, that is my journey.
we have to talk about that journey. So now that we've established our constitutional bona fides, and we will come back to that in a moment, and to winter wheat and to suffrage and all the rest of it, I'm just fascinated. Let's go back over the history of Kathy.
I've had the weirdest career.
Tell us.
I was not at all... interested in theater, and we didn't have a big theater program in high school. And I went to college. I majored in industrial technology.
Where was this?
At Eastern Kentucky University.
Uh-huh. So you're from this region, then?
Mm-hmm. I'm from Lexington.
Lexington, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I liked what I did. I was a drafter designer. I worked at various engineering places, and I became interested in theater. I was working at Whirlpool in Danville, Kentucky, designing.
Everybody who works at Whirlpool gets the theater bug. That's
a
standard story, right?
Because your alternative is to work at Whirlpool. And that's not true. Actually, they were a wonderful company until they sold us.
Right.
And then it was not so wonderful anymore. But while I was there, one of my vacations while I was designing vacuum cleaners was I had gone with a friend over to London to see a sister, and we saw Phantom of the Opera in the West End, and I fell in love. I mean, my mother had raised us, my whole family, on musical theater. We were familiar with it. But you know, that was my first big theatrical experience. Fell in love with that. The same friend and I, my friend Greg Terhune.
What year was that? You went to Toronto?
Well, 1980-something.
Okay, 1987-ish, so
okay. I think, 86, 87. So we had gone abroad, came back, and I started seeing a bunch of touring theater from the New York Broadway tours in Cincinnati. I'd drive up there. And then I got involved with my community theater in Danville, which was the sweet little theater, West T. Hill Community Theater. Still in contact with all those wonderful people, and I started acting. Mm-hmm. Fell in love. Forget designing vacuum cleaners. Forget those uprights versus right. canister vacs. I had a new calling. I did community theater for like 2 or 3 years, and then I knew, and the way only way an actor can know, that New York needed me.
It needed you. Okay.
No training. Get this. No training, and I'm going to go to New York to take it by storm.
Sounds like a religious calling.
I think it was an early midlife crisis. So I was 30. And I moved to New York and I auditioned for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and I got in. Mm-hmm. And I think they just wanted my money because I know I wasn't any good. And then they had to ask you to come back for the second term. And I wasn't any good, so they didn't ask me. But I loved New York. I loved theater. And so I auditioned, did that thing, and saw a lot of bad plays. For as many good plays in New York, for the record, there's about 5,000 more bad plays. Mm-hmm. And I saw them all because friends were in them. And I couldn't get out because the theaters were so small they would see me sneak out if I tried to crawl out.
Just
of them.
Part of the price you pay.
Oh, yeah, friendship.
Right.
Those people don't even know what I endured for them.
So you're not going to mention names?
No, I absolutely not.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
Just in case. Because I'd seen so many bad plays, I actually thought, oh my, I can write better than this. And I started writing, and one thing led to another, and I started producing my own plays first.
Before we go on, that reminds me of how another person took a different career path. Jimmy Carter.
Really?
Yeah, he wrote a book, as most presidential candidates do. Mm-hmm. I think it was called Why Not the Best. And he was governor of Georgia, and as governor, he would get this parade of presidential wannabes coming by looking for support.
Right.
And after 3 or 4 of them had come to the presidential mansion in Georgia, he said, I'm smarter than any of these people.
Right.
You know, I can do better than these people, so why not me?
Why not me?
And it was the same sort of experience
with
you.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is when you can learn just as much from seeing inferior work as you can be inspired by, you know, superior work. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. And I ended up writing a play. I read a lot of plays, of good plays, plays that I liked. And one in particular, a playwright I really admired was Horton Foote, who wrote Trip to Bountiful, among other things. Okay. Horton's a Texan. Okay. And he sets all his plays in this fictitious town of Harrison, Texas. And so I thought, I want to set plays in Appalachia. I went to Eastern Kentucky. We had moved to Kentucky when I was 13 from Michigan, so I'm not native. But
where in Michigan?
Battle Creek.
Battle Creek, Michigan. Well, it's a great state. You're from the wrong side of it. Both Wayne and I are from Detroit.
My mother was from Detroit.
Okay, well, then
count?
You're okay, then.
Come on.
It does count.
It is
count.
A great state.
It's a great state.
I love that place.
But you came down here to God's country.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Exactly. And then...
You want to set your plays here?
I did. I wanted to set my plays here. And so I started doing that, and Barter Theater, which I had heard of but had never been to before, has a great Appalachian Festival of Plays and Playwrights. I am probably now would be more of an Appalachian playwright than I was then. I was living in New York. But as long as the subject matter was Appalachian, you can enter. And I did, and I won that particular
festival. What year
festival.
Was this?
This was 2003.
Okay, so relatively recently.
Yeah, relatively recently. I had a reading of a play called The Other Side of the Mountain, and that was the first of a trilogy that I set in this town that I thought was fictitious as well, Mud Creek, Kentucky. Who knew it existed until I got a letter from somebody?
There is a town called Mud Creek.
Little Holler. Yeah.
Wow.
And she said, I'm so delighted that you picked our place to write about, and I'm like, I'm so delighted it exists.
Was the real Mud Creek similar to what you had imagined?
Pretty much. I think the real Mud Creek might have even been smaller than mine.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's just a little, you know, notch out of the mountains there.
But this is early 2000, so it was before Google Maps.
Right.
Okay, so.
But I did find it and I bought a map and went and found it and went and saw it after I had moved to Abingdon. But that's how my connection to Abingdon became. And I really fell in love with this area. Abingdon is very similar to the town of Danville, Kentucky, where I was designing vacuum cleaners. They're very similar feels. And as soon as I came down, I remember my father came with me. We drove into town for the reading. I went, I like this.
Mm-hmm.
I like this.
I think a lot of people have that reaction.
Oh, yeah.
It's a gorgeous place.
It is gorgeous. And this whole area is gorgeous and very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So I started having more plays done here, and I kept thinking I would much rather be, and I had a day job in New York, of course, mm-hmm. that I had had for 14 years that paid the bills, and I worked with wonderful people, but I was ready.
I'm just curious, what sort of day job does a playwright do?
I was working for a company called Chromacopy, and then it became C2 Media, and it was a digital printing. I would start off as photographic printing, but then became a digital printing company. And so my job there, and I think I was the only woman in New York who ever did this, mm-hmm. that may not be true now, but it was at the time, was I worked in the mounting department, which sounds much more exciting than
that
it
sounds
was.
Very exciting,
yeah,
but
it?
Tell us what you mean by mounting.
But we'd take big prints and mount them to the boards that they would hang on in stores, like foam core or illustration board or gator board or masonite. And, you know,
and
I
that
was
paid the bills.
It paid the bills. And they let me go after 7 years. I worked freelance. So I got paid a lot more money. No insurance, but a lot more money.
And you could work from
and
your
I would
own
work
studio.
And I did. I would go when they needed me, which was about every weekend, which was great. One of my friends was a manager.
Right. And so you could do that, but
and
still
I
write your plays.
And I wrote I wrote fervently so that right. I would not. It was a pretty taxing job physically. Mm-hmm. It hurt my back. You were standing on cement. Even concrete floors all mm-hmm. day.
But playwriting is not a physically tough job.
I was a pretty tough broad, though. I could do it, and I walked to work.
Tough
so it was
broad.
Like,
You're the first tough broad self-described that
I've
interviewed.
But physically tough at the
time. I understand.
Time.
Okay.
It was also almost 10 years ago. So
okay.
I don't know if I'd say
so
that.
So you had your day job.
Yep.
You're writing your plays.
And,
You're
and
in
then,
New York.
And Barter,
come to
I have this connection with Barter.
Right.
And my roommate, who I'd lived with for 10 years in that six-floor walk-up, he had the lease on the apartment, and he said, I want to live here by myself. And I'm like, oh, no. We lived in Soho, which is a pretty posh neighborhood, but he had like a, what's it called, rent-stabilized lease.
Sweet.
Our rent was total was $800 a month, so we split it.
Wow.
And now he had gotten a job that he could afford it, so now he was giving mm-hmm. me the boot after 10 years. I don't blame him, except now I needed to find a place to live. And I moved to New York in 93, and this is 2007 or
right.
something.
And Abingdon beckoned.
And I got a phone call from Katie Brown that said, Rick's looking for someone to be a playwright in residence. Do you want to come down? And I said, I would much rather live in Abingdon than in Bushwick, Brooklyn,
yeah.
which was an hour and a half commute.
Sure.
Yes. And that's how I ended up at Barter. I'd had
Very
a bunch
cool.
of plays
A different
done.
World, though.
Oh, yeah, but I had lived in Danville, so it wasn't that unfamiliar to me.
Right.
And it was a place where I'm working with some incredible theater artists. Listen, Barter Theater changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean in the best way possible for so many reasons. But the biggest thing I learned was, I've been working with, first, Rick gives me all these opportunities to write, which mm-hmm. is necessary to growth. But I also met John Hardy, who is an associate director there. And he taught me, he has a doctorate in playwriting and is a wonderful dramaturge and taught me so much that my formal education lacked, I learned from him. And I learned really how to write there. During my time there, in the last 10 years I've been at Barter. And what I learned most importantly, though, was, and this was from Katie Brown, who's the artistic director of the Barter Players, is that theater is nothing if it's not service.
Mm-hmm.
You fame and fortune do not fill the hole. But when you're out there writing to inspire your audience or to educate or enlighten or to entertain your audience, and it's not about you, then all of a sudden the ego gets pushed away, which it desperately needs to be done. And things that need to happen to make the play the best it can be are allowed to happen. Because it's not about, but you know, some people are very much, or can be, I suppose, those are my words and they're important, every one of them, even if they get in the way of telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's more important than telling the story that will serve your audience.
This reminds me of something I tell my writing students. I have occasionally over the last couple of decades taught writing courses.
Mm-hmm.
And I will always say that the most important thing to remember is to know thine audience.
Yep.
And it's about the audience. It's about making it clear and useful and perhaps even enjoyable for the reader. And I think you can broaden that, especially when you talk about artistic endeavors. It's about the audience.
Right.
I've heard people say art for art's sake. And as you say, you know, every one of my words is precious. Well, that's fine. And if all you want to do is create something and then look at it yourself in your room, well, then that's fine.
Absolutely.
And, indulge. Go for it.
I'm
Absolutely.
Telling you, it's life-changing when you...
I've always thought of art the same way you do, which is that, yes, it's creative. And yes, it comes out of you. But it is for an audience.
It is such, and it's
and
so the collaborative.
Exactly. That was the next word I was going to use. Collaborative, especially when you're talking about the theater, because, of course, you've come up with an idea or Rick's come up with an idea and you've fleshed it out and you've got all the stuff down on paper. But that's all it is until the next stage.
Those actors and directors take it.
Right.
And in this case, composer Ben Mackle, who had to, you know, and it's not always fun and games. It's not like we're in a room, you know, eating donuts and drinking coffee and agreeing with each other. It's arguing about why we think something should stay, or arguing why we think something should be changed or go or rearranged. And it's headbutting and it's frustrating. And Nick Piper, who directed this piece and who is the head of the Barter's Shaping of America series, has really shepherded this thing through its process.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly delightful conversation with my new friend, Kathy Bush, who is the playwright in residence at the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia. We're talking all about her new play about the women's suffrage movement called Winter Wheat. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, then we'll come back and speak some more with Kathy Bush. Stick around. I'm looking across the table in the brand new Potter studio with my bud, the quiz guy, Doug Smith, and we're both just sitting here beaming because it's such a thrill.
Beaming.
To be doing a quiz in this lovely studio.
It's great, isn't it?
It is fantastic, and you deserve a great deal of credit, Doug, because it was you who spearheaded this entire effort. So well done, sir.
Now you can quit. Very kind. No, I'm not quitting the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier.
Oh, you're not? I thought we'd be rid of you once the studio was up and running.
No. Now there's world domination ahead.
Okay, so this is just a springboard to world domination. Tremendous. Well, let's begin dominating our first person, shall we? Who do we have on the line?
This is Nick Arms from Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the atoms flow and people
That's absolutely right. Where the people are green at night.
And the people glow green at night, Nick. Well, we're very happy to have you with us. Doug, you have a tough quiz question for Nick?
I do. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to read you a question. I'm going to give you four choices. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay, Nick. What federal elected office includes being entitled to the nobility title American Knighthood? What federal elected office includes being entitled to the nobility title American Knighthood?
Wait a minute. You're saying there's a federal office, and if a person fills it, that person has the title of knighthood?
If you are elected, you become an American knight.
No clue about this, but go on, please. What are the choices?
This is
completely off the wall to me. I have no idea where you're going with
Nick,
this.
I'm going to give you four choices. So who essentially...
I'm going to need them.
Who gets to be called a knight?
Sir.
Yeah, by
Sir
virtue
Doug.
Of the office. Here comes A, the president.
Hmm.
B, members of Congress become knights.
Hmm.
C, the Supreme Court.
Hmm.
Or D, none of the above.
Hmm.
What
Nick?
Federal office comes with the title knight?
Who gets to be sir or dame, I suppose, if it's a woman? Do you want to hear those choices again, Nick?
I would love them again, actually.
Okay.
A, presidency. B, members of Congress become knights. C, the Supreme Court. Or D, none of the above.
Nick?
I'm just going to go out on a limb and say D, none of the above.
Wait a minute. If you're elected to Congress, we're not going to call you Sir Nick?
I suppose not. I'll have to give that title up.
So D, now you don't want to try any of the others?
No, we're going to stick with D, none of the above.
I can't get him off it, Doug.
There's a good reason for that. The man knows his Constitution.
Indeed. Nick, congratulations.
Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, the Emoluments Clause.
Right, which has been much in the news lately.
Much in the news, but nobody's talking about knighthood.
Well, it's often called, actually, the Titles of Nobility Clause as
titles
well, because
it
bars federal officials from receiving emoluments, which is any sort of advantage, really, broadly defined, which can be either monetary or it can be in terms of something else like a title. And there are a number of reasons that it was passed, certainly to get away from the sort of corruption that had roiled Parliament, where such things were common and bribes were common by the Crown for people who were favored within Parliament. But the Titles of Nobility Clause had a deeper meaning, didn't it?
Well, it was pretty straightforward. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. I mean, there's no question what is meant here.
Right. And the fundamental reason was that we did not want the sort of titled, stratified, ossified system that existed in Britain at the time.
It would be so anti-agrarian.
Yeah, anti-democratic, anti-everything that we stood for, anti-Republican, if you prefer, to have those sorts of titles. In fact, from time to time, there's a bit of a brouhaha when some foreign country gives such a title to people here, perhaps in just an honorary sense. And occasionally, at least if they're federal officials, they have to decline.
Yeah, that's right. They absolutely do. And, you know, maybe most importantly, we sometimes talk about the differences, particularly for our listeners in the UK, the differences between our form of government and a parliament. Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of them. There is no nobility.
There's no nobility.
Yeah.
I'd kind of like a knighthood. I kind of like it.
Sounds nice.
If I were king, I would knight you.
Would you knight me? Thank you so much.
And I would knight Nick.
Sir Nick. Knight Nick. Well, Nick, you didn't get a title of nobility, but you are going to get a YWC t-shirt. So please go ahead and send us an email or a message on Facebook and send us your t-shirt size. And we will put it in the mail to you along with a pocket constitution from James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
That's wonderful.
Thanks, Nick. And thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Dad.
Hey, it's the Constitution. We're going to make it great again.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Kathy Bush, the playwright in residence at the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia, who's written a wonderful musical play called Winter Wheat, all about the women's suffrage movement and the adoption of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution. It's been certainly a constitutional discussion, but also a very artistic discussion, and she's been telling me about how very collaborative the theatrical process is and how sometimes it can be a little bit frustrating.
I got really frustrated at one point, and I'm like, I have so many other projects I can be working on. Because I do. I'm mm-hmm. constantly working on something else, which is a great place to be in. Like, I did this. We tried it. If it's not right, I'm ready to move on if they're not happy. And Nick was the one who said, no. We're going to take this to the next level. We're going to buckle down and do it, you know. I was actually a bit whiny. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say it, but that's what happened was my ego got in the way and mm-hmm. my lack of attention span. And you have to, and he was just...
I think that might be the hardest part of being a creative person is taking that criticism and recognizing that it is constructive.
Right.
And embracing it rather than pushing
right.
it away.
Oh, it's...
That's tough.
It is tough. For our Appalachian Festival of Plays and Playwrights, the audience gets to tell you what they think about your play.
Right after the show's over?
Right after it. And they don't know who you are. And they know who I am at this point. But I had a play in the reading in the festival this year that, like, tanked.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And they told you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man,
and then a panel who told me, too.
Oh,
in case
rough.
I didn't hear it from the audience, they wanted to make sure I got it.
Oh.
And they weren't doing it to be mean. I mean, I know they like me.
Right.
But, oh, the big old ego came
Sorry,
out.
Kathy, you missed on this
yeah, you
one.
Missed, yeah, you missed.
Oh, boy.
It stunk. Yeah. Which Ouch. Means I'll probably, excuse me, in a year, a few months or something, I'll pull it back out and take another stab at it. But right now I'll work on the things that I need that have another deadline.
Well, we could talk about this all day long, but let's bring it back to the reason that I called you or why Kate Foreman over
right.
at the Barter called me. Hi, Kate. She's a marvelous person. She's in charge of advancement
she
there,
is,
right?
She is, thank goodness. She's doing a great job.
She's the money person.
Keeping Barter alive and kicking.
Kate called me and told me that you were doing something. You were about to produce something that had been in the works for some time.
For 3 years now, yep.
Let's take it all the way back to the beginning. Let's take it from the call that Rick gave you or
sure.
when he spoke to you when he came up with this
idea. I think
idea.
This one was actually an email. He sent me an email. He had seen the movie Iron-Jawed Angels, which is about the force feedings for the women's suffrage. There were two movements, the National American Woman's Suffrage Association mm-hmm. and then the other one, whose initials I forget, under Alice Paul. So Carrie Chapman Catt is NASA, let's mm-hmm. say. And then there's Alice Paul's group. And Alice Paul's group were picketing the White House. They were real radical, and they were picketing the White House during Wilson's administration, saying we want, during the war, World mm-hmm. War I, saying we want the vote. How can you say you're fighting for democracy when half your population can't vote? And so Wilson...
More than half.
Right.
Right.
Wilson put up with it for a while. And then these women were being arrested and thrown into prison, terrible conditions. And so they went on hunger strikes, and then force feedings occurred. And mm-hmm. that's kind of what Iron-Jawed Angels is about. And Rick had watched it, and he said, we need to look at women's suffrage. as an idea for a play. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I knew nothing about it. When I went to high school in the mid-70s, we might have mentioned Susan B. Anthony's name.
She got her dollar just a few years later.
Yeah, she got her dollar. Mm-hmm. And that's probably why I heard her name. But we never studied any of the women's stuff. I never knew about Seneca Falls in 1848. I didn't know anything. And so for me, it was starting at the beginning and doing a lot of research. And I didn't want to do about Alice Paul and the Force Feedings because that had been done. They'd just done a movie. So I'm reading a lot of books, and I find this book called Women in the 19th, or Founding Sisters in the 19th Amendment by Eleanor Clift. I think that was the name of it. And I'm reading it, and a lot of it is stuff I'd read before. And the last chapter was called A Letter to Mother. And it was about this young congressman in Tennessee named Harry Byrne.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they needed 36 states to ratify. The amendment had been passed in June of 1919. Mm-hmm. Here it is, 1920, and they're trying to get the 36th state to ratify before the 1920 presidential election. Mm-hmm. Time's running out, and it comes to Tennessee. And this young congressman has to make the decision. I mean, it's tied up. It's 50-50.
State legislator.
State legislator.
That's where they were at, right.
Yep, state congressman. And he is, there's a battle in Nashville unlike any battle since the Civil War, probably, or maybe even greater. Bribery. People were flocking there, pro and anti-suffrage, and it was like down death grip. It was completely tied up. And then this thing happened. I don't want to give away too much of the play, but it's sure. about this man's, Harry Byrne, and his relationship with his mother, Feb,
right.
who was a well-educated woman, read 4 newspapers a day, couldn't mm-hmm. vote, but her illiterate tenant farmers could. And so I read this, I'm like, oh my goodness, this story is local. I mean, it takes place in Iota, Tennessee, right down the road.
Right.
And it does what I love to do when I write a play about history, a historical play, is it takes this whole cataclysmic event, that national event, and it reduces it to a very personal family story.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, yes.
Now, I'm going to try not to give away too much either. I will simply say this, that the straight historical narrative is something we have talked about extensively on the show. In fact, several years ago, roughly the time that Rick Rose was sending you that email, I was speaking to a woman named Wanda Sobieski, and she is a practicing attorney in Knoxville. And Wanda knows as much about women's suffrage.
I need to get Wanda to see the show.
I think Wanda has seen the show.
Has she?
Because I think I alerted her to it some time ago when I saw it being advertised.
Right.
So Wanda is a marvelous resource. But I'm simply going to make that reference that if people are interested in the subject, they can go to our podcast site for your weekly constitutional and simply enter in women or suffrage. Mm-hmm. And Wanda's, I think we gave her, she's been on several times.
Great.
And there have been others as well. So I think I know where you're going with this. And I know that it's not only a remarkable climax, but there's a strong element of humor in the Harry Byrne saga.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I know where you're headed with this. So we'll just leave it there, that this is what it's about. But now, how did you address this? Your play is actually called Winter Wheat, right?
Right.
Where'd you come up with that,
that
title?
I posted on Facebook. I use the Facebook. Mm-hmm. I just said, oh, I'm so excited. I've been commissioned to write a play about women's suffrage. And a friend of mine who's a professor down at Vandy, Amanda Kynard, she said, oh, that's so wonderful. And she goes, my favorite quote is, and it's Elizabeth Cady Stanton quote, we are sowing winter wheat. Of course, I can't remember. We are sowing winter wheat, which will grow in something and which other hands in ours will reap and enjoy.
Right. And that's really the whole history of the women's movement. It was 70 years.
Well, if you don't count when the country was founded, because, that was 72 years from mm-hmm. Seneca Falls, but, Abigail Adams was talking about it.
Sure.
Back in the day.
Well, the issue of feminism, what we call it today, or women's rights, has been with the human race since there's been a human race.
Right, right.
But certainly most people date the beginning of the American women's suffrage movement to the Seneca Falls Conference in 1848.
Yep. And so they... What were you talking about?
That's perfectly all right. We were talking about the actual history.
Oh, right.
And you incorporated that in your story.
Right.
You had the foresight to recognize a really great story. Rarely is history quite as narratively satisfying as the final ratification battle in Tennessee
was.
I mean, just the real straight history.
I couldn't believe it fell in my lap that I opened this book and there it was.
So did you stick fairly closely to what actually happened?
I, I, I know, Winter Wheat. That's what we were talking about. We were talking about the title. So this friend of mine said that this was her favorite quote. So here we are. So I'm like, oh, Winter Wheat. I love that as a title. I mean, I had the title before I started writing. Mm-hmm. And as so often happens when you're lucky, and I have been lucky, it was so useful as a metaphor for throughout the whole play. Because as I said earlier, Feb Byrne had illiterate tenant farmers who worked for her. And I thought, oh, great, I will use this farm. I needed an in into the family. Mm-hmm. I needed, she has her sons, Harry and Jack. She had a daughter who had passed away. She had another daughter as well that I did not need in the story. And as we do when we dramatize sometimes, we change history and pretend somebody doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And instead, I brought this this character of Ruth Abbott, who is the daughter of one of an illiterate tenant farmer who has come to work in Feb's house. So this is my outside eye looking into the family dynamic.
Okay.
So, which is something I was able to create with this character. And Ruth also is illiterate. Mm-hmm. So.
But what a contrast. Illiterate men can vote.
Right.
But a literate woman cannot.
Right. Or literate, or
A woman can't vote regardless of whether she can read or write.
Or not, right, mm-hmm. right.
And that's quite a contrast.
It was something. There's so many interesting characters who surround this whole thing. But that's how it kind of came together. I created Ruth and her father Samuel. He's the illiterate tenant farmer, and Ruth is the daughter. As the outsiders coming into this family. Other than that, almost everyone else is real. They were the fictional part of the story. Forrest, who owns the Mr. Forrest, who owns the hardware store, was real. A couple guys who frequent the hardware store were made up. But everybody else, Carrie Chapman Catt is in this as a side. So you have her story and the Byrne family story coming together until it all meets up in Nashville. Carrie Chapman Catt.
Where the confrontation was called, if I recall correctly, the War of the Roses.
There's a song called that.
The War, exactly. Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, we'll get to the music in just a minute. So you had this natural climax
that
was coming together, and literally the people in Nashville and the state legislature were wearing either red roses or white roses, right?
Yellow.
Yellow roses, excuse me.
Pro-suffrage and the antis were red.
And many of the state assembly people or the state legislators would have roses of each color in their pocket, and they would switch the roses depending on who they were talking to.
But who was going to bribe them the most?
Bribe them the most or lobby them the most or whatever it was.
It was phenomenal. And, you know, and of course, the players, that one of the players that interested me the most was this character named Carrie Chapman Catt, Josephine Anderson Pearson, who was anti-suffrage.
A real person.
Yep.
A woman anti-suffrage,
anti. Oh,
right?
Oh, yes, very anti.
A lot of women were anti.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she wasn't, it was... wasn't like she was uneducated. Her mother was a school teacher who taught Latin and Greek, and she was very politically connected. But she had power. She didn't need the vote. She had the ear of every politician in Middle Tennessee. Mm-hmm. She got done what she needed to get done, and she did good with what she, you know, she built roads and educated the poor. But, she was a racist, mm-hmm. as so many people, you know, were back then and still are. And she was an elitist, and she didn't want to give up her power.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Kathy Bush, the playwright in residence at the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia. And she's written a perfectly marvelous play called Winter Wheat, all about the women's suffrage movement. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with playwright Kathy Bush. Stick around.
The sacred fire of Vesta burned in Vesta's circular temple in the Roman Forum until 394 AD. Tended by the Vestal Virgins, the eternal fire represented the life and soul of the city and the body politic. George Washington's 1789 inaugural address, written by James Madison, parallels the great American experiment of self-government to that eternal flame. He writes, "And since the preservation of the sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the republican model of government are justly considered as deeply, perhaps as finally staked, on the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people, During Madison's presidential years, he had an architectural allusion to the Temple of Vesta, constructed on the Montpelier property to represent that sacred fire of liberty and the constant tending that the life of society needs to flourish. Today, it is fitting that while Montpelier pursues its civic education mission, we likewise restore the symbolic Madison Temple.
Hey, it's Stuart Harrison. It's your weekly Constitutional. We're talking about women's suffrage. And before we go on with our interview today, I just wanted to mention that we've talked about the subject several times, and it's a fascinating and very important subject. And if you'd like to listen to those past episodes, please Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional Podcast, and you'll come up with our podcast site, and you'll be able to find those episodes and listen to them. And I hope that you will. This week, of course, we're talking with Kathy Bush, the playwright in residence at the Barter Theater, who learned a lot as she was researching her play, including the fact that not every woman was a supporter of women's suffrage. You would think that any woman would want the vote in the first instance. And to the extent that you realize that there are some women who were anti-suffrage and who didn't want the vote, you would tend to think, oh, well, they simply must be ignorant, or perhaps they're being dominated by their husbands or
married.
Other men.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the case. Many of the antis, I think, might simply, as you were pointing out, have simply gotten accustomed to a certain status quo.
Right.
And comfortable in that status quo.
And
as you say, powerful within that
status quo. Absolutely.
And so, though it seems counterintuitive to us, no, we don't want the vote. We like things the way they are because, at least for us individually, we like it this way.
And the actress playing Josephine Pearson is from New England, and she goes, I am trying to wrap my brain around this. This is so hard. And to say some of the racial things she has to say during the play.
That's tough, too.
Yeah, that's tough.
But that's period accurate.
Yep, yep.
And sometimes it's relevant.
Yep.
Before we leave this idea, I was reminded of something. Some years ago, I was sitting in a dentist's chair, and the hygienist was a woman. And all of a sudden, she started railing on feminists and feminism. And I was, again, a bit taken aback. I was,
sure.
At a certain point, I said, but aren't you a woman? Don't you like the fact that you've got more choices now? She said, oh, no. Back in the day, I women didn't have to work. I could have stayed home and been watching my soaps all day and eating bonbons. So she didn't like the idea that women could now work more broadly than they did, or that they were accepted outside the home, because she had embraced the idea of being a traditional homemaker and no longer felt she had that option.
And that's,
now she was expected to work.
And that's ridiculous, because if that is something that you would want to do, staying at home and keeping a house and raising children, I don't think there's a harder job on this planet than
that. No, there's not.
Frankly.
But she didn't feel she any longer had the option that her family or maybe her husband all expected her to work.
Right.
And so when things do change, expectations do change.
Sure.
And so it was logic to her position. Now,
right.
She was a woman
who didn't have to work anyway, because a lot of the women who wanted suffrage were working, mm-hmm. making nothing,
right.
and had no say.
But it's more complex than just, pro or anti.
Sure.
There are lots
of
gradations.
I remember Paris Bradstreet, the actress, and I were talking about it, and I said, I think she didn't get married or have children. She took care of her parents. And I wonder, we were talking about this from an acting point of view to wrap your brain around it. I said, I wonder if she gave up all of the husband-children thing to take care of her parents and to do this good for society. And then if the society can do good for itself, then what's her role? And what did she gave it all up for what?
Right.
I don't know that that's true. I didn't know Josephine Pearson, but I'm going to put that spin on it, at least for an actor, to kind of, it raises the stakes. You've
sure.
got a lot to lose when everything, you've given up everything for this, and now it's going to be taken away from you because they can take care of themselves.
The power of the status quo.
Yep.
Very interesting. Okay.
Yep.
Let's go back. So basically then we've determined your play, Winter Wheat, which was recently staged at the Barter Theater,
yep. mm-hmm.
to sold out audiences.
Some of them were. We've had a few, a smaller house, but nothing small.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
Some,
it had done very, very well at the Barter.
It's done great. We've been very proud of it. Yep.
And you've hewn fairly closely to the actual story.
Yep.
Because you were smart enough to recognize a really great natural story when you got it.
Yeah, I didn't need to go too far with it. All right.
Okay. Finally, we get to the part of the creative process that most intrigues me here. How does one make a musical?
Wow.
Out of such a serious subject as women's suffrage in the early 20th century.
Isn't that something? I'd worked with Ben Mackle, is my composer, and he was a Barter resident actor for a while.
Right.
And he began writing music during his tenure as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had written a play for the Barter Players, the theater for young audience Barter. We had done Aesop's Fables, and we had done that together. And so we were like, let's try something else. So we wrote a proposal to Rick together that we wanted to do this piece. And
You were the lyricist then.
I'm the lyricist.
You're right. The lyricist, and of course you write the so-called book.
The book and
okay,
lyrics.
Okay, so
right.
you're writing the play, you're writing the lyrics that go in the songs, and then...
And he has the tough job, because he has to try to, and I am willing to admit, and we'll shout from the rooftops, that I know nothing about music. I don't know an eighth note from a quarter note, didn't even know those things existed until somebody told me.
Mm-hmm. You know, but that's
and
okay.
And I will hear something in my head, and like the real magic to me is when somebody else comes along and can take this form that I've written words in and create this beautiful complicated melody or a beautiful simple melody or...
Well, I think you've answered the next question I was going to ask, which come first with your collaboration.
Lyrics.
Lyrics first. So you've got a book.
Mm-hmm.
You've decided, I want to put a song here.
Right.
Okay. And let's start with that process. What makes you think you want a song at a certain page in your play?
Yes. Usually, and that's interesting, usually a character shouldn't sing unless there's the stakes are so high or the need is so great that the only way to express their emotion is to sing. And in fact...
Basically, you're looking for emotionally poignant moments.
Yeah, when it's pitched out of fervor that they can't help but sing or... something can only be explained to somebody. I can't do this except to sing this to you.
Okay.
That's the level they need to be at. And so that's what we look for. When I first wrote it, we started in 2012. So it went through many iterations. And I thought I wanted this one song. I remember I had a song. We wrote a song for the men at the hardware store that was going to... sum up the feelings of men during this time.
Mm-hmm.
What they thought about women's suffrage coming down the pike and how things are changing. I mean, World War I had just ended. Nobody's staying on the farms now that they've seen Paris.
Mm-hmm.
People are taking off. Indoor plumbing is new. Tractors are new. The world is changing. And that's really kind of what the play embraces. And so I'd written a song for these men in this hardware store that I thought was really funny. And Ben... because he's a man, probably said, he goes, this sounds like hee-haw to me. Like, this is hee-haw. We're not what, nothing else in this play is like this. And I'm like, yes, but I don't mind having a humorous song in the middle of a pretty serious piece. But he was right.
In that instance.
It was hee-haw. So he stepped up and said, I don't think this is like kind of stereotypical man versus what... were men really afraid of. And so we ended up writing this, I think, beautiful song called The Smell and the Mess, you know, using the metaphor of indoor plumbing, like all that smell and the mess goes away, but you don't know what's going to happen. Where does it go?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the mess? What's going to be left behind?
So you wrote a song about poop.
About a toilet. About the sewage system.
That's creative.
Dude.
Wait just a second. Okay.
Not many other people could probably claim that.
Wait a second. Just back up now. So we've got a play, in outline at least, right? You've got a play that's in progress.
I probably started on it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've identified places within the play where you think mm-hmm. that you need
in my
some
outline.
Song. Okay,
yep.
In your outline.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One of those had to do with, let's talk about what the men are feeling.
Right.
And so that's the point at which you narrow it down to, okay, how am I actually going to approach this problem?
Right.
Your original approach with the men was too hee-haw and too careful.
Which was also about a toilet. I mean, a toilet has come into town and everybody's like, what is this?
What is this new thing?
Toilet. This is amazing.
Okay, wow. So that's an aspect of positive change then.
Right.
At least potentially.
Feb Byrne had one installed and that's who it was ordered for in this play and didn't like it. Didn't prefer it.
Right.
Yeah. It's just really interesting, like, because it's different.
Right.
Change is hard. And so some people were excited about it. Some people aren't. And the song, which had been kind of like men belong on the throne with the toilet as the metaphor for that.
Right.
Which Ben said, no, that's too hee-haw. We went to what is it that's happening in the world? And The Smell and the Mess talks about men going off to war because somebody shoots somebody else and we all go off to war and die in the trenches, and that when we come home from the war, we've seen the world and we're not going to stay here anymore. And that's another change that we're dealing. And now women want suffrage. And what are we going to do with this? And how is this going to change our lives? And who's going to take care of, they'll want our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to watch the kids. We'll have to cook for ourselves.
And those are really big issues. And I think younger people might have difficulty understanding that. But
yeah.
as recently as the early 1980s, I remember having discussions with women I knew on campus Now, my particular university had only been what we used to call co-ed for about 10 years at that point.
Wow.
Okay, so it was still a period of adjustment. But I remember having very serious discussions with young women. Wait a second, how can you do all these other things? Who's going to take care of the kids?
Right.
You know, what's going to happen to home life if you women, if you girls at that time, they were young, don't fulfill your traditional roles?
Right.
I mean, that's a frightening thought. And
it's
how do we adjust it?
It's a frightening thought today to a lot of people. And
even to well-intentioned men. I mean, who like women are trying to share and all the rest of it. But how are we going to do? Who's going to take care of our kids?
When the kids get sick and we both have jobs.
Right.
It is. I remember.
And those are serious issues.
I remember my mother telling my younger sister, who is an engineer, her husband had just gotten his doctorate in chemistry or chemical engineering or something. Physics. I don't know. Molecular biologist. That's what he is. Science. Right. And my sister was making a lot of money, and my brother-in-law wanted to move to get this job that would make half of what she made. And my sister said, I'm the breadwinner. And my mother goes, you can't do that. He's your husband. And my sister said, oh, yes, I can.
Mm-hmm.
I make the money.
And did the marriage.
And I have the insurance.
Did the marriage last?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Married,
well,
yeah.
He acquiesced.
He goes, you're right. If we move there, we won't be able to feed the kids.
There have been several times during my now almost 30-year marriage where my wife has made significantly more than me. And I tell all my friends, far from feeling demasculinized, I simply enjoy spending the money.
No kidding.
I've got no problem at all.
Get your priorities straight,
gotta
boys.
You've got to get those priorities straight. But getting back to your play. So mm-hmm. you put together this song, and you obviously have to have some sort of structure. You're writing what amounts to a poem.
Right.
Do you focus on typical lyric writing that emphasizes rhythm and meter and rhyme?
I try to. And Ben mm-hmm. is a little more free fall than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where some of the headbutting would come in. And it was interesting. On that particular song, people did not like it when we first did it 2 years ago because I hadn't written a chorus. And we had this wonderful musical director named Zacchaeus Kimbrell who came along and like I said, I don't speak the language of music, and he does. He goes, okay, you guys, this is what this thing needs, because right now it's too repetitive, and we need to do this. We need verse, chorus, bridge, chorus.
Mm-hmm. So he's trying to impose a more traditional style
on the songs. Needed it, and it made it so much more pleasing. There's a reason those exist.
Right. I mean, certain conventions are very useful.
For the audience's ear, and we added it, and it's dynamite. We had one person singing it, and Zacchaeus suggests three people sing it,
mm-hmm.
and then the three men in the store, and it just changed everything. And that's what I mean by collaboration, too.
Right.
And Ben was able to fix it, and Ben's music, his music in the first mini production kind of took a hit. First of all, it was his first draft. Second of all, it was piano only, and he had written it for more instruments. And third of all, most of that was my fault. They just didn't know it because I'd written a song that didn't fit, and I had my scenes in the wrong order. The second and third scene had to be flipped mm-hmm. and rewritten, one scene rewritten. And so the difference, people are so funny where they'll have seen the mini production or they'll have seen it from the beginning as we've developed it and come in and go, wow, that's amazing. You did this and this and this to this character, didn't you? And I thought, no, that's the one character we didn't change. But we changed everything surrounding her.
Right.
It's so funny.
So
yeah.
It changes the impression of the audience.
It changes the impression that people have loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It's been so exciting and exhilarating
right.
to know that through all the gnashing of teeth and pulling of hair and everybody's patience with me and my whiny state, et cetera, that we have been able to create this thing that I think tells this great story in a time where we need to hear about women voting and about, there are so many lines in this play that I can say these without giving away that mm-hmm. are so oddly relevant right now. And again, we started writing it 4 years ago. Things like one character, Mary Garrett Hay, a suffragist, tells Carrie Chapman Catt that they're yelling vile insults to women in the streets. Obscenities. And mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, yes, some are still doing that, you know. And then there's one line that goes, the Republican Party is in the middle of a political feud. Yes. Another line is, do you want to be reelected or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what are we willing to do to be reelected?
Mm-hmm.
It is
lots of modern relevance.
Wow.
In fact, I'm reminded of the call by at least some people who are supporters of Mr. Trump. And by the way, this is going to be broadcast not only after the run of your play. Sorry about that. That's just the way the timing worked out. But also after the national election for president
right.
is over. So I hope people won't accuse us of being partisan. But I have to note that, a lot of women are not very happy with Mr. Trump. And a
sure.
lot of women are going to be voting against him for some of the things he said. about women. And it's led some of Mr. Trump's supporters to actually suggest, perhaps facetiously, but perhaps seriously, that repealing the 19th Amendment would change things. Isn't that remarkable? That even jokingly, people would talk about taking away the franchise from over half of the population.
Amazing, because the polls came out, or the you know, polls being what they are, but that if only men voted, he would win.
Right, and that was, I think it was 538.
Yes.
Wasn't it Nate Silver at 538?
I think so, yep.
I think simply he was struck by the divide, the gender divide in this. And so he said, what would it be like if only men were voting and all of a sudden the map just changed from blue to red?
Right.
That was striking. And so at least perhaps
and
facetiously.
To me as a woman, frightening.
Well, okay.
Yeah,
I understand.
Like, wow.
Isn't that a remarkable divide?
Right. Yes. And still today, and it makes me sad. But I have to say...
Well, but wait a second. I think you can look at it completely differently. You know, this is the result. I mean, we gave women, finally, the franchise. We enfranchised more than half the population. It's had an effect.
True.
I mean, if it didn't have an effect,
well,
then you could look back and say it's no big deal.
Right, you're right.
But when you bring women in the room, by golly, things change.
I think it was just sad to me that with only men voting, it wasn't even... You know, like that it went all red.
Speaking as a man, Kathy, we're all troglodytes. I mean, so it's just, you know, it's simply not true.
I know it's not true because the ones standing up at the end of the play, leading the standing ovation, are men.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that was going to be my last question. We are running short on time here. What has been the reception?
It has been marvelous. You know, it has been marvelous. The men are there with their wives. There's a lot to laugh at. And it's a play that addresses some problems that the South had with the federal amendments in general. Mm-hmm. And this is a Southern audience. And yet they get it. And they are so happy. They are so happy at the end of it. Like, they're thrilled when the vote goes through. And that's not the end of the play. Something else still has to happen. You know, that's... Mm-hmm. And so it's been thrilling. I mean, I have gone to every performance so far. I have to miss one tomorrow, but that's probably the only one I'm going to miss.
Right.
Because it's thrilling to sit in the audience, remember our journey, and to see this result. It's cool. Our first audience was 165 12 and 13 year old kids, and at intermission one little girl looked at her friend and said, I am obsessed. Isn't that great?
Kathy, I can't think of a better way to finish our discussion here. But for those who are sitting there gnashing their teeth and saying, why didn't you broadcast this earlier when maybe I could have gotten a ticket? Again, we apologize for the timing. It's just the way it worked out. It was a conflict with our fall fundraiser and all the rest of that. Is this going to be produced again at Barnard?
I hope so. You know, we have the 100th anniversary of the women's right to vote in 2019-2020.
Right, it's coming up.
So
I would think
actually,
this would be...
It's coming pretty quickly. And I know other theaters are interested in it for that reason.
Right.
And I'm hoping, I keep fingers crossed, that maybe Rick in 2019, 2020 will bring it back.
Well,
maybe even tour it a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's sold so well this time. It's been so popular.
Yeah, it's really, and I think he's really proud of it, and he should be proud of it. Commissioning new works happens so seldom in theater, and he does it often, that he needs to be patted on the back 1,000 times over for what
he's
done.
Well, Rick Rose, we're patting you on the back.
Absolutely.
Even if only over the airwaves. And so thank you for this idea.
Yep.
And thank you, Kathy, for writing the play. And thanks to Ben for writing the music. And thanks to all of the Barter Company for putting this on. And let's hope that people can go and see it at Barter or elsewhere again in the not-too-distant future.
Let's hope so. And thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to the playwright in residence at the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia, Kathy Bush, for telling us about her play, Winter Wheat. Thanks also to Rick Rose, the artistic director there at Barter, for having commissioned this play. Good job, Rick. Good show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you're part of that majority of people we call women.